This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes. Also, make sure to check out and subscribe to our YouTube original channel, UCTV Prime, available only on YouTube at youtube.com/UCTV Prime. This UCTV podcast is sponsored in part by Audible.com, your destination for the widest selection of digital audiobooks available, including many by guests you've heard here on UCTV. Audible.com is offering UCTV podcast listeners a free 30-day trial subscription and one free audiobook download. Just visit audibletrial.com/UCTV to sign up. That's audibletrial.com/UCTV. And thanks.
Thank you for joining us for this evening's Exploring Ethics program at the Reuben H. Fleet Science Center. I'm Mike Kalichman. I am director for the Center for Ethics in Science and Technology and also a director at the UC San Diego Research Ethics Program. The Ethics Center, as many of you know, but not all of you, we seek to have a conversation with the public. The purpose of these programs is not simply to lecture to you, but to hear back from you as well. The goal here is for scientists and academics to hear the diverse perspectives of the community that we live in, and that's what you're here for. So you've got a job tonight. It's not just to listen, but to participate in that conversation. This evening's program is the second of six in what we are calling the Silent Spring series. This year is the 50th anniversary of publication of Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring. And in honor of that, we have a series of programs which will be looking at different aspects from an ethics perspective of the questions raised by Rachel Carson in her book and the questions that are still raised today, some of which have not been answered since then. This series is a joint effort. While I'm from UC San Diego, this series is a collaboration among diverse institutions from throughout San Diego, including California State University San Marcos, Grossmont College, Point Loma Nazarene University, San Diego State University, and the University of San Diego. In addition, we, of course, have an ongoing relationship with the Fleet Science Center. So this is truly a joint effort intending to try and look at ethics issues across the board. Before introducing tonight's speaker, I will just note one thing that I learned actually from a member of the camera crew. I had not heard it, but apparently today is literally the 60th anniversary on the day of a terrible incident in London where coal-burning power plants put so much pollution in the air, combined with the weather system, that over a period of 4 days, the city was virtually choked by the fumes from the smog that were there. And they estimated that an additional 4,000 people died. 4,000 people died early deaths due to that incident. That's not something to commemorate, but it's something that it's noteworthy that on this evening, when we're talking about Silent Spring and protecting the environment, that we have that anniversary. So tonight's speaker is Dr. Mitchell Thomashow, director of the Second Nature Presidential Fellows Program. The Second Nature Program assists colleges and university leadership in promoting sustainability on their campuses. He's here in San Diego working with the University of San Diego this week. He's had a variety of roles in addressing sustainability and environmental issues and is the author of two books relevant to tonight's discussion, Ecological Identity, Becoming a Reflective Environmentalist in 1995, and Bringing the Biosphere Home in 2001. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Thomashow for this evening.
Well, it's really wonderful to be here in San Diego. I was last here about 40 years ago, actually. So it's you really get to see a lot of environmental change when you come back to a place after that many years. This is just about the maiden voyage of this presentation. So I'm honored to be able to give it here, and I'm really anxious to see what you all think and to get some of your thoughts about it. Check this out. Here's a series of advertisements from the year 1951. And we have the big three, I guess. Television, cars, and Coca-Cola. Now, this, if we had a long time, I'd ask you what this evokes for you, so, and we talk about it, so I'll ask you and think it through. What does this evoke for you? These ads, the promise of affluence, 6 years after World War II, and think about where we are now. This is a scene from 1951 also. They're spraying DDT in the streets. Now, when I was 5 years old, maybe a little bit older, my cousin Judy here, I've only seen a few times in the last 40 years because her family moved out here, we used to run through this together, and we called it, when the dispenser came, we called him the Fog Man. Remember that? And we'd run through the fog of this DDT. So this was the other side of 1951, the toxic side. And it was supposed to be good for you. This is going on too. I lived in fear of this for years and years and years. I remember growing up with the mushroom cloud. It's almost trite to say this now, but I would hear a siren. We lived in New York City, not far from the airport. I would hear a siren in the middle of the night, and I think, is this it? Even as a little boy. I mean, you know, when you're sitting in a classroom and you're 5 or 6 years old and you're doing a drill and you put your head down on the desk to protect yourself, even at 5 or 6, you know that that's kind of stupid. So these are two very different impressions of that early era of the 1950s. This promise of affluence, the abundance that was just at our fingertips, and also this toxicity that was becoming a part of the world. I see a lot of people here who are, well, close to my age and probably remember this very well. So who knew what to think? Also in 1951, stick with me, we're going to be starting several themes simultaneously here. Rachel Carson wrote The Sea Around Us. What's amazing to me about this book, not only its astonishing prose, but this was on the New York Times bestseller list for 6 weeks. You'd be hard-pressed to find another environmental book or book about nature since then that's had that longevity as a bestseller. So in the midst of the dark clouds of mushrooms and A-bombs and DDT, Rachel Carson is writing this spectacular book, which is a testimony to wonder and the glory of nature. And it's on the bestseller list. All this is happening pretty much, I was born in 1950, around the year of my birth. It seems like it may be out of left field, but it's not. I've been very influenced by the great Jewish philosopher Abraham Joshua Heschel. And he wrote a book in 1951, too, called Man is Not Alone. One of the things that's really interesting about Heschel is that he was born a prodigy. He was a rabbinical prodigy, and most of his family perished in the Holocaust between 1939 and 1945. He came to the States in 1939, went to Cincinnati, and then he wrote this book. English was like his sixth language or something. It's a wonderful book. You should check it out. Beautiful prose and philosophy. And here's one of the interesting things about this book. Heschel writes, the book is filled with pithy prose, by the way. Indifference to the sublime wonder of living is the root cause of sin. And that was his explanation for what happened in Germany. He never specifically refers to the Holocaust. But instead he says this. Because when that indifference suffuses an entire culture, everything comes crumbling down. So I find the synergy of all of these things quite amazing, actually. And I find the timing of it quite amazing as well. Rachel Carson's writing about wonder as well. One of her biographers, there are three very fine biographies of Rachel Carson. The second one, in chronology, is Linda Lear's fantastic book, Rachel Carson, Witness for Nature, and she writes about Rachel Carson. For Carson, nature writing and popular science were vehicles of human redemption. Every effort to confront the mystery and wonder of the natural world, no matter how inadequate, gave deeper meaning to human existence. So here there's also the challenge of meaning that emerges from Rachel Carson's work, and I think that's why it was a bestseller. People are looking for meaning. People are looking for hope. People are looking for something magnificent in the world in the midst of the unleashing of these extraordinary toxicities. And I think, we're going to get to it in a minute, that there are four themes that are crucial to understanding Carson and her times, and our times as well. Because we're bookending this, and you'll see why later in this presentation, 60 years later. It's amazing that 60 years have passed. Here are the four tensions that I think are inherent in Carson's work, and I think are inherent in our lives. And I'm going to go through them, not one by one, but they're going to penetrate all that I'll be speaking about. One is the relationship between indifference and wonder. A second is the relationship between creation and extinction. A third is hope and foreboding. And a fourth is transparency and suppression. To me, Rachel Carson's life embodies her ability to work through these challenges and these tensions in a way that was absolutely heroic and very meaningful for our times as well as hers. I'll say more about each of these as I proceed through the slides. Wonder is the holy grail of environmental education. I've spent my entire career working with environmental studies students, and now my work is with sustainability, but there's always been this wonderfully naive aspect of environmental education. If they only knew what we know, they would act as we do. And it's completely wrong. And human beings don't operate that way. But I tell folks, never give up that naivety. Because that's the wonderful naivety of an educator. But there's this sense that if you can somehow generate an ethic of care, people will, in fact, act differently towards the natural world. And so how do you generate an ethic of care? You develop experiences that allow for wonder, and you cultivate that as much as you possibly can. And I think you can say that probably ought to be true for any kind of science education, for sure. I don't know what can be more important for science education than cultivating a sense of wonder. I say this all the time when I'm working with any students, undergraduates in particular. If you can come out of school after 4 years and you've cultivated a better sense of wonder, then this school has really served you well. Some pictures of wonder, in case you forgot what it looks like. Here's a little formula for you scientists, right? And this is a formula that comes really directly out of Rachel Carson, although I'm not sure she necessarily used these words. Creative imagination plus acute observation plus sympathetic identification plus scientific accuracy equals observational ecology. Rachel Carson was the first among 60 years of great nature writers in America. I think America's contribution to the literature of nature is its singular contribution to world literature. And so many of her peers and those who've succeeded her have used this same kind of formula. It's absolutely crucial to our understanding of ourselves in the world. Creative imagination, all of these together, not one or the other, all of these together are the algorithm, if you will, for observational ecology. Rachel Carson wrote an essay called Help Your Child to Wonder, which appeared in the Women's Home Companion of July 1956. I couldn't resist. By the way, all these slides are taken off the internet, which is pretty incredible also. I had a lot of fun putting. I'm in the middle of writing a book, so I didn't want to write text. I want to just. These slides are so evocative. For that first slide, the one on with the televisions, and I just put 1951 into Google. What's this going to yield? And my favorite one was all those advertisements. And then I kind of stuck them together a little bit. Well, I found this one too. Why you can't afford to be sick, it says. Well, anyway, here's what Rachel wrote. Once the emotions have been aroused, a sense of the beautiful, the excitement of the new and unknown, a feeling of sympathy, pity, admiration, or love, then we wish for knowledge about the object of our emotional response. Once found, it has lasting meaning. That is her philosophy of education. It's a resilient philosophy of education. It matters as much now as it did when she wrote this in 1956. Rachel Carson wrote about creation. The Edge of the Sea came out I think it was, actually this came out around 1956. And what she does in this book is she writes about creation. If you read any of her prose, it's teeming with life. It's a testimony to biodiversity. It's a testimony to cycles, observing nature cycles, rhythms, and interrelationships. This is what she did better than anybody. She's a painstaking writer. She only wrote 4 books. Rachel Carson again. Understanding comes only when standing on a beach, we can sense the long rhythms of sea and earth that sculptured its landforms and produced the rock and sand of which it is composed. When we can sense with the eye and the ear of the mind the surge of life beating always at its shores, blindly, inexorably, pressing for a foothold. This is the algorithm again. Here is sympathetic identification. Here is the creative imagination. This is observational ecology. I thought it would make sense to have a bunch of biodiversity slides in here. This is the single issue that we face. We hear mainly about climate change, but really there are 4 interrelated issues that represent our planetary emergency. One is the extinction crisis. I'll say more about that in a minute. The decline, plunging declines in biodiversity, the rapidly changing oceanic and climatic and atmospheric circulations, and the changing biogeochemical cycles as well. These are the things that, this is why I do sustainability. Sustainability is a response to a planetary emergency, and the big issue really is species extinction. This is one of the hot spots right here. This is a wonderful map. You can't really see the details, and there's no need to, but this represents some of the biodiversity hot spots around the world, and there are several right here in Southern California. You scientists know them better than I. This is a stunning slide for me because look at 1950 and look at 2010, because this is the time span that we're talking about right now. If you look at 1950 human population numbers and you look at species extinction numbers, that's where the slope gets exponential. The two go hand in hand. I'm not sure that population necessarily drives all these issues. I think that's the easy answer sometimes. But still, this is a pretty compelling slide. There have been 5 mega extinctions during the history of life on Earth. We're in the 6th right now. This is the first that's anthropogenic. That is, this is the first one that's human-caused. Rachel Carson had an inkling about this. That was the point of Silent Spring. What will these toxicities unleash? So here we have this relationship between creation and extinction. On the one hand, the more you study the natural world, the more you are just enamored with the extraordinary diversity of life. Yet on the other hand, the more you study it, the more you understand the threats. So this is kind of an existential dilemma and challenge that she was right in the middle of, which is why I oppose them that way. These are some of the most threatened species in 2010. Most of them, with the exception of the monarch butterfly, are the so-called charismatic megafauna. But we know less about the number of species that live on this planet than we do about the number of stars in our galaxy. We still are way off exponentially in terms of what lives here, mainly because we don't really understand the numbers of soil microorganisms. I mean, think about the number of soil scientists compared to the number of, let's say, lawyers. So it's no wonder that we don't have this knowledge. But here we have this incredible planet with all this biodiversity, and we really still don't know who our neighbors are. Rachel Carson wanted to introduce you to your neighbors, which is why you should go back and read The Sea Around Us. As she writes, "It's a great problem to know how to penetrate the barrier of public indifference and unwillingness to look at unpleasant facts that might have to be dealt with if one recognized their existence." So we have this turning point in her life in the mid-1950s, late 1950s, where she becomes aware of the impact of DDT and other toxic chemicals. And Rachel Carson didn't have a political bone in her body, which is true, by the way, of John Muir and Thoreau and many of the great environmentalists. Didn't have a political bone in her body. Didn't matter to her at all. But suddenly she was thrust into controversy. By the way, talk about women in science. We'll get into that in a moment. But she knew what it was going to mean when she began to challenge the orthodoxy around these kinds of issues. And here's her statement about it. She didn't know how to penetrate the barrier of public indifference and unwillingness to look at unpleasant facts. And that's so true today as well. It's a really hard challenge. I mean, how do you tell folks about these sorts of things? How do you make it important? How do you make it necessary? Again, Rachel Carson, I have no idea whether I shall be able to do so or not, but knowing what I do, I have no choice but to set it down to be read by those who will. I guess my own principal reliance is in marshaling all the facts and letting them largely speak for themselves. So her science and her research were impeccable because she knew what kind of scrutiny she would be under. Silent Spring comes out in 1962. It's a book of great controversy, another bestseller, influenced many people. It was really the first critique of its kind. It was the first book that took on the chemical industry. A second biography, which just came out this year, On a Farther Shore by William Souter, which I highly recommend. Souter writes, at its heart was a single proposition. Because all life on Earth shares a common biochemical evolutionary history, the idea that a synthetic poison can target a single class of organisms and do no other harm is folly. In essence, that's what Silent Spring is. That's the challenge to the orthodoxy. That's the ecological vision that Rachel Carson had. So the attacks began. Monsanto, Velsicol Chemical Corporation, and DuPont were right out front. Every imaginable kind of attack, a communist, aspersions about her spinsterhood, things that had nothing to do really with her work in any way whatsoever. All distractions, really. And she had to deal with all of it. And she couldn't, it was not unlike Jackie Robinson as the first African-American baseball player. It didn't matter what was thrown at him or what was thrown at her. They had to stick with the vision of what was important and be totally, totally focused on that. Meanwhile, she's dying of cancer. And she couldn't let anyone know that she was, because then folks would think, oh, well, she has a vendetta. So she's going through this incredible suffering, real suffering, and wanting to get the book finished, and then making all these public appearances. A very private person who became very public after The Sea Around Us. But then this elevated her to all, you know, to really world notoriety. Meanwhile, Monsanto works with a scientist to write a book called The Desolate Year. And The Desolate Year, which is widely distributed for free, essentially is telling the American public, well, if we stopped using DDT, insects would run the world, and we wouldn't have any food. So the propaganda war began. William Souter, I hope I'm pronouncing it right, I don't know him, writes in his biography, industry and its trade affiliates were even more worried about the possibility of new government regulations, expensive testing procedures, and stricter federal and state oversight. Does that sound familiar? So this, again, there's so much we can learn from this. Now, it's also, I need to say, and this, I'll end with this theme as well, Rachel Carson was not opposed to pesticides use by any stretch of the imagination. She understood there was a time and place for pesticides. There were good reasons to be using pesticides in areas that were malaria infested, for example. The issue was, is there any regulation at all? And how do we, there needs to be some kinds of checks and balances on the use of pesticides. So she was not at all unreasonable about this, and really quite prudent, and very much a scientist. But because the polarization occurs in all of these kinds of public issues, just, you know, look at the last election, the sides were drawn, and people really didn't quite understand that, in fact, she was a scientist, and she understood the importance of using pesticides in certain circumstances. But meanwhile, she was getting tremendous support. And these are some of the great figures who were supporting her. I'll go through them. On the upper left, Ed Wilson, the great evolutionary ecologist who works at Harvard, written some wonderful books, a book called The Diversity of Life, which you should all check out, another book called Creation. And he was a strong supporter of her work while she was doing it in the late 50s. Marjorie Spock, some of you from my generation will, of course, know Baby in Child Care by her brother, Benjamin Spock. Well, that's Marjorie, a tremendous supporter of her work. Thomas Merton, the great Catholic theologian. Albert Schweitzer on the bottom. Lauren Eisley to his right. Chief Justice William O. Douglas, a Chief Justice of the Supreme Court who was an environmental activist. Just, you know, incredible thing. And on top of that, Stuart Udall, who was a great Secretary of the Interior. And to the left is her good friend, Dorothy, great friend, Dorothy Freeman. So she had all kinds of support from many of the most important figures of the century, and certainly of that decade, while this is going on. So I want to return to these themes again before we close. These are tensions that I've experienced that I find just about anyone in this field, anyone who thinks about the human condition. And one of the interesting things about all of this environmental challenge, if you think about climate change, think about species extinctions, what all of it does is it brings lots of attention to the meaning and purpose of humanity. Because this is our agency. These are the results of things that we've done. So who are we on this planet? What do our actions mean? And why are they important? That's often forgotten. The best chance I think we have to understand what it means to be human is to study the world, to study the earth, to study other organisms. Because we all live in this narcissistic dream world. We're constantly surrounded with images of people and images of things and images of ways to be. The only way out of this is to better understand the other. That's why there's a difference, by the way, between multicultural diversity and biodiversity. It's by understanding the other, by understanding the planet, that we have a much better sense of who we are as individuals, who we are as people, who we are as a species. And these are the things that we have to balance. If you're in a state of wonder all the time, you're unbelievable. You're insipid. No one's really like that. But pity the poor person who's constantly in a state of indifference. These are balances. These are lifetime balances, lifetime challenges, spiritual challenges, if you will. Creation and extinction. There is a background rate of extinction. Species perish. You've seen there have been 5 previous mega extinctions during the history of life on Earth. So what's our role in relationship to the 6th one? And what are we doing to call attention to the wonder of creation? Hope and foreboding. There's something hopeful about studying the natural world. I used to tell that to all the students. When I recruited students for our college, I was president of Unity College in Maine, I'd always say to the parents, by studying the natural world, your kid is always going to be imbued with hope on some level, because that's just what goes with it. Yet there's this sense of foreboding that's a part of our lives as well. And it's the balance between the two. If you're always living in a state of foreboding, you turn into a neurotic mess. The hope is essential. And this relationship between transparency and suppression, which I think is also at the core of Rachel Carson's work. Her idea was to make everything open so that we could all see it. Let's see all the facts. We don't want things hidden. We want to understand it. But she was dealing with suppression. And this is a very important challenge. So these are some of the key themes. And we move 60 years into the future. And I'm not going to, you know, hit you over the head too hard with these things because you know about them already. But, you know, the coral reefs are pretty much on their way out. So if you haven't seen them, you better get over there if you can. We've got the melting of the ice cap. And, the science is becoming increasingly clear on this challenge. Desertification on the lower left and deforestation on the lower right. These are global challenges that are... Sometimes I feel I've woken up, and this is appropriate to say, given the fact that we started in 1950, I've woken up in a science fiction movie. And all the things that we were talking about in the late 60s have come to pass. And here we are, whatever it is, 40 years later, 2012, and this is the Earth that we've got to deal with. This is the planet that we have to manage. And Rachel Carson's wisdom is incredibly helpful in lending guidance to that. Here are some great pictures of Sandy, by the way. Our hometown of Woodmere got really wiped out. I have a friend from high school who told me that they're still cleaning up. And it's just, he said, you'd be shocked by looking at my cousin Judy at Woodmere Boulevard. You wouldn't recognize it. So the place where we grew up, this is an incredible picture on the lower right of the East River. This is what happened in New York City. I'm working with the Boston Green Ribbon Commission now, which is a group of the Boston real estate people, higher ed folks who want to work on climate adaptation, because it could have hit Boston. It could hit Washington. So that's the era. That's what we're into now, is adaptation. And I need to also say that I think we're on the verge of some extraordinary new technologies. Between synthetic biology and genomic engineering and geoengineering, there are going to be technological advances that are going to make the world much more sustainable if we handle it the right way. And the price point, the innovation in terms of materials, in terms of energy efficiency, in terms of how we deliver food, in terms of how we deliver water, how do we get rid of waste, the networked science that's possible, it's all there. It all can happen. But it won't happen unless we have good regulation and unless we think about this carefully in terms of how to proceed. So I am a scientific optimist, and I think through really great science we're going to be able to solve a lot of these problems. But it has to be done in a way that's measured and sensible and contextual. So we can have a planet that's sustainable. We can have a planet that's a blend of the scientific and the spiritual that encompasses all this tension, that deals with issues of equity, and that promotes and promises a much better life. And I think that's Rachel Carson's vision, and I think that's what should inspire us to move and act as 60 years later. Thanks very much.
My name is Jeff Kirsch. I'm the executive director of the Reuben H. Fleet Science Center, so welcome.
Thank you.
Dr. Thomas Hsiao. I had the privilege of doing some interviews in a younger stage of my life with Jonas Salk, and in one of them, he had written a book towards the end of his life, and he introduced a different kind of curve than an exponential curve. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it's the sigmoid curve, where it goes kind of like this exponentially, but then it hits a saddle point, and then goes like that and levels off at a higher level, not returning down and crashing down. And he said this was some, I forget, and it was a little bit on the utopian kind of point of view, I guess, that eventually we have to recognize that we have to turn these curves into sigmoid curves and not let them go exponentially. That's nature's solution, which he then went in and explained in various ways how nature and colonies of crowded little creatures actually do this kind of sigmoid solutions to the environmental issues. Do you think something like that will have to happen? I don't see any alternative, because outside of dramatic crashes and catastrophes, that we have to be able to recognize that as a society, as a global society, that these things have to happen. But without having a global society, can you really achieve that?
Mm-hmm. Okay. All these multifold questions challenge me.
This is a spitball. It's not a curveball.
It's a spitball.
I'm from Brooklyn originally.
All right. Well, I'll post you out one-on-one outside. So anyway, it's good to see that Brooklyn's got a basketball team. This discussion really is a discussion about carrying capacity, largely, it seems to me. And that's a very controversial question. There's a wonderful book called How Many People Can the Earth Support that really goes through various population dynamics. And the reason why the carrying capacity question is so complex is because it's not only about the sustainability of the Earth's resources, but it's also about equity and social justice. And who gets to have what? So I can't really answer that question, because I honestly, it's hard enough for me to think about 2020, let alone 2050. We do know there's a flattening that's beginning to go on, and that we do know that there's a flattening that's typically attached to affluence. The birth rate in Europe is flattening. In fact, it's declining. Right, so it could be that once the world moves through this new phase of globalization and economic growth, there is a flattening that begins to take place. The question is, how much damage will we do in that process? And I really don't know. And, you know, there's such controversy also about this whole question of how many billion can live on this planet. So that's the best I can do with a very difficult and important question. But here's where I'm a little concerned. I think sometimes population is an important issue, obviously. And that curve dramatically points out the relationship between population and extinction. But I'm worried that often we misuse population to have reactionary views on immigration and to avoid the equity challenge. So I think we have to be very careful when we attach population exclusively to issues of carrying capacity.
Yeah, so this is related to a second question I wanted to ask. So there are certain things we can say. One is we cannot sustain unlimited growth. Eventually, there just won't be space for people on this planet. So we'd have to move somewhere else. So, and if we assume this is our only place to live right now and we don't have the means to move somewhere else, then what's happening in innumerable countries around the world is that simply to have the space and the needs for those people met, they are deforesting their environments, resulting in a loss in biodiversity. So I'm not going to say it's direct correlation, but it's probably a reason why those figures of human population and loss of biodiversity are so similar. So there isn't, without a one-world government and dictatorial rules from the top, there isn't a solution that's going to stop that population growth. So given that, what can you conceive of that we can do to retain biodiversity in the face of that unending surge of population?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, it's really interesting being asked all these tough questions. And I guess I'm a child of the interdisciplinary 60s. Because the body of knowledge that's required to answer these questions well, honestly, I don't have. So I just want to make that clear, right? If it hasn't been made clear already. I just want to make that clear. These are very highly speculative types of questions. The challenges of biodiversity, I mean, we've been through so many different possible solution approaches, ranging from wildlife corridors that connect relatively wild areas to making sure that there's a good mix of humans in these various landscapes so that the areas are actively used, to working on various ecotourism solutions. And it seems to me that, you know, we're still trying to figure this out. These are so new. I mean, the word biodiversity in and of itself wasn't even coined until 1986. So it's been, 25 years since we've had this concept. Ecology is 1890. Evolution is 1860. So we're working. Earth system science is first coming into its own now. When did plate tectonics become? 1960s, maybe? Later? So, oh no. Well, it was hypothesized by Wegener in the 1920s. But we didn't really have the data that suggested that plate tectonics is, in fact, the prevailing theoretical approach to how the continents move until, I guess, the 70s. So I guess what I'm suggesting as a way of finessing my way out of this one is that we really just don't know yet. But here's what intrigues me. I think there are a lot of interesting solutions that come about through networked science. In fact, there are so many people who can share information now, through various types of microfinancing procedures, through social entrepreneurship, the kinds of new approaches, for example, to providing water, to turning waste into energy. There are lower, not on the geoengineering scale, but there are small-scale innovations that can make a huge difference in the quality of lives around the world. And I heartily, you know, endorse all of those. And I think that's the way I think about a way out, is through that kind of remarkable social entrepreneurship and networking science that's beginning to take place.
Okay. Fair enough. So I think we have a couple of questions here.
My name's Tate Hurwitz. I teach English, so I'm even less qualified than you to answer any of these questions. But let me offer this. It seems to me that Rachel Carson's legacy is sort of complex in that, on the one hand, she offered us a sense of our duty to the planet in an ecological model. On the other hand, she also took us out of an era of faith and trust in science and into one of skepticism towards science that now ironically includes skepticism towards environmental science. And I wonder kind of if you think that's a fair attribution, and then second, if you do, which legacy has had more impact?
Wow, interesting question.
I think that's a good question.
Yeah, it's really good. Well, I think that the sense of duty and sense of skepticism, as you put it, to that I'd add a third, which is a sense of vulnerability. And that was what I was trying to evoke as well. And the vulnerability is hugely important. I don't know that a sense of skepticism towards science necessarily conveys or moves towards a sense of skepticism about environmental science. I think the skepticism about environmental science, or more recently climate science, has been a function of the incredible amount of resources that's been thrown at it by the oil industry, pure and simple. They've really, really invested heavily in disputing the science. That's what I think.
Back in the late 1960s, early 70s, you may remember this, there was a movement that became very popular called ZPG, Zero Population Growth. Mm-hmm. It gained a lot of momentum, basically maintained if every couple had 1.8 children, which I believe they allowed to be rounded up to two, we would not only level off, the population would actually drop down. I lived through it. I don't know what happened to it. How did it fizzle out? And more important, do you think we can revitalize it?
Yeah, it's. I appreciate your rounding up reference, by the way. A lot of it's happening on its own accord. It really is. I'm not a demographics expert. But a lot of it is happening, especially in the so-called developed world, a lot of it is happening of its own accord. Birth rates in China are going down as well. So I think we seem to have increasing evidence that suggests when a certain standard of living is met in a country, the birth rate is probably going to go down. To answer the broader sociological question as to why it fizzled out, I can't really say. I don't know. I didn't follow that particular movement specifically.
Well, was the data wrong? Because, I mean, when you look at how many people since the late 1960s have entered the Earth.
There's a lot.
I mean, that's, well, as we've all been saying, exponential.
Yeah.
So was the data wrong about CPG? Because, as you said, in some countries, I don't know about this one, the population growth is sort of leveling out a little bit.
It's really hard to tell people how many kids they can have.
Yeah, I know.
If you, it really is.
I hate to say it, I had four.
Yeah, well.
And I apologize to everyone in the room.
Although I'm working at a Catholic university this week, I'm Jewish, but if anyone else wants to confess anything.
Well, I have six siblings, and most of them, three of them had none, and the others had only two, so at least we sort of leveled off.
I think actually at the heart of your question is a very profound point. And one of the challenges for the environmental movement and now for folks who are working in sustainability is it looks often like they're making demands about how people should live. And Americans don't like that. They just don't. So it looks like there are restrictions on something, it feels like, I mean, you can't tell me what to do with my land.
Yeah,
you can't tell me what to do with my money.
Right.
You can't tax me. is a really important and very legitimate strain in American public life that responds negatively to those kinds of demands that we have to give full voice to and understand its importance. That's why I like the sustainability approach, because it's solutions-based, it's community-oriented, it gets people working together on things that are actually going to change their lives. And I've been thinking a lot about, and I will write in the introduction to this book, which is due with the publisher in 2 weeks, that sustainability ought to be based on an abundance model. I don't mean an affluent model, but an abundance model as opposed to a scarcity model. Because the scarcity model has driven a lot of people away from the good thinking that we need in this regard. And I think that's where I'm taking your question.
Yeah.
I need to ask about one piece of this, and that's, and I don't know this. So in the United States, is our population growing because of a birth rate that is too high, or is it growing because of immigration, or is it a combination of both?
Yeah, I don't know. Does anyone know the answer to that question?
Population's living longer.
Well, that's the, that's another factor, right? Yeah, that's a, so we know that that would be one reason. So one mistake was to have good medical care and good medical research. So what about the birth rate in this country? Does anybody know what their birth rate is in the U.S.?
It's just not linked to an environmental problem they're having. You're making an assumption right away that population and environmental degradation are linked, which was has been disproven over and over again, like you mentioned, or at least problematized.
Right.
So
thank
think,
you.
I think, you know what I mean?
No, your point is well taken, but
footprint or whatever is big because of corporations, because of all these other, different things that we can put.
Yeah, so, and since that wasn't on the microphone, I think what you're pointing out is that we don't have a direct link between population growth and environmental degradation. But I think the question, right, the initial question I think that is an interesting one, is to the extent that we are saying the planet has a limit to its capacity, and we are saying we're concerned about population growth, the question is in the United States, is our population growing despite the fact that people are having 1.8 children or fewer? And because of increased length of life, that would be one factor, increased immigration, and that would mean that the population growth is occurring in other countries, not here.
Well, the population is growing. You can't deny that. That's demographics. That's the census. The thing you really want to know is the birth rate growing.
Right.
The birth rate is variable among different groups and among other groups. So the population is growing. That's a fact.
Yeah, that's clear in the United States and worldwide. And the question was, the United States, has the population growing despite having kept the birth rate down to what ZPG was looking for? And I don't. And it looks like nobody here knows the answer to that. I'll look it up and contact me later if you want to find out. So, next question.
Hi, I'm Angela Budreka. I believe the conversation got somewhat sidetracked. I had read at least half of Rachel Carson's book, and I'm continuing to read the rest of it. And as a mother, I feel like she was being the canary in the coal mine and warning people about some of the things that were happening. And the takeaway that I got from that in modern society is, since there are so many pesticides and herbicides being put on the plants, let's eat more organic food. So that's one of the things I got. And another was, what about all this technology that we're having, for example, cell phones, computers? My own children are already teenagers. And so what would be, for example, the long-term health effects of people being exposed to EMF and radiation and things on a continuous basis? Simple solution, a great book is called Grounding, and this is Clint Ober's work, and talking about having the bare foot just on the soil, the sand, the grass, or rock, and that decreasing a lot of that and creating natural health benefits. And then my third point is, how many of us are actually even spending time outside? So many people are living life indoors, and the idea of playing outdoors or being outdoors, you know, how much of that is really going on? Maybe in San Diego we have more of that because of our beautiful climate and our ocean and our environment. So these are some questions I have.
Yeah, so that was multiple things. And if I could just try and summarize it to a couple of points, it sounds like on the one hand, you're concerned that there are new technologies we're developing for which we don't know the long-term consequences. The research hasn't been done.
Right.
On the other hand, You're stipulating that there are things that we could do by being closer to the environment, such as walking barefoot, for which I don't think the research has been done either, right? So that's just a possibility, or is that...
No, that is an actual book that does have some research attached.
But there are... Well, anyway, I'll let you try and take those two possibilities.
A lot of research is being done on the effect of cell phones and the effect of using these technologies, and the jury is still out, you know? I mean, if your particular position on this is that the risk is too great, then you have to act accordingly. I think it's very helpful for us to know as much as we can about these things. That's all I can say, really. I'll tell you an area where I think we've made tremendous progress, and that is in food. We really know a lot more about the relationship between what we eat and our health. And one of the great costs in American public life is healthcare. And the relationship between obesity and diabetes and now Alzheimer's is becoming increasingly clear. And that's an area where we've got good science, we've got good research, we can make a tremendous difference in people's lives just by looking very carefully at the food that we eat. So I think that there are, I love it because you could have a tremendous impact that way. And again, it doesn't necessarily have to break down into partisanship in one sense or another. So I try to look for these areas where you can integrate people's lives with the natural world in ways that are fundamental to everything that they do. You're not going to get, you know, everyone to go outdoors. I mean, Richard Liu, I think he lives in San Diego, right? You know, he's got the whole thing. And my old colleague at Antioch New England, David Sobel, you know, strong believers in getting kids outdoors as much as possible to play. I think that's a great thing, for sure. But it doesn't matter how much we think that. The trend is not that way. So where, how do we find where people are at? That's why, by the way, I've gotten so into sustainability. Most people spend most of their time in buildings. So can we think very carefully about the building as a natural artifact? Get more natural light into buildings. Think very carefully about, you know, how we live our lives inside buildings for when people are inside. Anyway, that...
More plants inside the building.
Well, more plants for sure, yeah. Or grow food. Vertical gardening. Vertical roof and rooftop gardening. Integrating the city with the countryside. The most ecological thing, the most sustainable thing that we can do is have really first-rate, sustainably oriented cities.
One more question, I think, and that should be it.
Hi, I'm Sarah Giordano. I'm a professor at San Diego State University. Thank you for your talk, and I'm glad to be here for the first time engaging in this ethics conversation. Hope to be a part of it longer. So I guess the question that keeps coming up is what we can do, right? And what models there are to do something about, you know, I think we agree mostly in this room that there is a problem, even if we don't agree exactly on the problem, right? So my understanding is that a lot of even the understanding that there's some kind of problem was based on grassroots environmental movements. And there continues to be a lot of grassroots environmental movements. So I guess I wanted to hear a little bit about what you know about how that can help our present day situation. But also specifically, I don't know a lot about Rachel Carson's life, and you said she wasn't political at all. But I was wondering what kind of social grassroots environmental movements were happening at that time, because I'm imagining it wasn't her individually who discovered what was happening with DDT. So do you have any evidence in the research you've done or the work you've come across as far as what influenced Rachel Carson as far as actual, like, more grassroots organizing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thanks for those two great questions. Let me start with the former. There are some... fantastic student movements right now in relationship to sustainability. There's a conference in Maryland called the Smart and Sustainable Conference that meets annually. There's the work that President Clinton's doing at the Clinton Global Initiative University, which brings several thousand students from around the country who all are engaged in service of one kind or another. There's the Ashoka program for Changemaker Campuses. University of San Diego just got that designation. I am excited and delighted and thrilled by what I see happening with students. Now there's a divestment movement that's going on. Bill McKibben, who wrote The End of Nature in 1986, has been doing some extraordinary activism And he's doing he's got his Do the Math tour right now and trying to put a pressure on colleges and universities to divest of oil stocks, like similar to apartheid. Now, whether that's the exactly right approach or not, you know, other people can conclude. But all I can say is that he's generated tremendous momentum, and it's very exciting to see. One of our great writers, by the way, who got his start at The New Yorker as well, who's really turned political activist. In relationship to Rachel, so I'm very hopeful and very excited, and I think just the very, here's why I'm most excited. What they can actually change, one can't predict, but to get involved and engage in civic life matters enormously. And we saw in the last election, you know, what happens when people get engaged in civic life. In relationship to Rachel Carson's influence, I highly recommend you read either of the two terrific biographies, Linda Lear's Witness for Nature or Bill Satter's book, because what you'll see in those books is that, in fact, she was supported by a grassroots movement. And without that grassroots movement, I don't think she would have been nearly as effective as otherwise.
Yeah. Excellent. So thank you very much for your question. Before I turn to some closing announcements, I want to thank Dr. Thomas Show for an outstanding, impassioned presentation, which was really useful.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.